Hey guys, welcome to episode 232 of the True Crime Couple podcast. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope all is well and that you're ready for another episode. Now, if you're new to Patreon, please stay tuned at the end of the episode so we can give you a shout out and say a special thank you for joining our family. And if you want ad-free episodes and two bonus episodes a month, please go to patreon.com/truecrimecouple. And that's it. That's all the housekeeping. So very short and sweet. Because today, the case I have for you is a doozy. So let's get into it as soon as possible. John, do you want to hear something crazy?
Of course.
The stillness of the hot June morning in Babberton, Ohio, was broken by the creaking of floorboards beneath the small feet of a six-year-old girl. She was unsure of what had happened or what she had suffered. She just knew that she was scared. As she searched the home she was in, the brutality of the previous night revealed itself to her. Just hours earlier, she had been laughing with her beloved grandmother, and now she lay dead at her feet. Someone had slipped in their home in the middle of the night and destroyed a family's world. And yet, the most haunting part of this story wouldn't be the bloodshed itself. It would be the years that followed. Because the little girl who staggered through the neighborhood at sunrise, traumatized and barely alive, carried with her the only account of what happened inside the house. Her words would shape the investigation, divide a family, and eventually help lead to justice. Because the killer had always been right there.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
On the afternoon of June 6th, 1998, Brooke Sutton had been dropped off at her grandmother Judith Johnson's house. The six-year-old girl was excited. She loved spending time with her 58-year-old grandmother, as she doted on her endlessly when they were together. Judith Johnson herself had two daughters. First was Melinda, who had been adopted, and then 10 years later, she had April. Melinda had two sons, and April had given birth to Brooke, Judith's first granddaughter, and she just adored her. Judith Johnson lived on Summit Street in Babberton, Ohio, which is southeast of Akron. The town was larger than that of the more rural areas that both her daughters had chosen to reside in, but all the towns were close enough for everyone to visit each other, and visit they did, as Melinda and April remained close with each other and their parents, even after Judith and her husband chose to divorce later on in life. Brooke loved spending time with her grandmother as well. She thought Judith was kind and funny, and she just always felt cared for when she was there. The night went as it normally did, and Brooke had gone to bed before her grandmother did. When Judith retired, she slept on the couch in the living room so Brooke could have her bed. It had been a very hot night, and hoping for a breeze, Judith decided to keep some windows and the door open.
When you say door open, do you mean actually open?
Yeah, so the screen door was closed so breeze could get through the door as well.
Oh boy. And this is what, 1999 you said?
1998.
Okay. Wow. I'm surprised. I feel like around 1998, you know, I think everyone got the memo. Hey,
well, I think lock your doors. a communal Ohio town, everybody did feel safe and felt like they knew their neighbors, and they very much did. So she felt like she was safe enough to do that. And the way her house is situated on her property is it is set back a ways. So it wouldn't be obvious to someone like walking down the street that the door was open.
Well, that's actually a really good point to like keep in the back of your mind then, I guess. Is that the house is set back, so you're saying you can't be seen from the street?
Well, the house can be seen from the street, but it wouldn't be as glaringly obvious as a house that's kind of butted up against the street, like the other houses are around her. that the front door is open and the storm door basically is the only thing shut.
Gotcha. Okay. Trying to get a mental picture for the house.
Well, I like painting it, so.
I know. I love this.
Around 2 or 2:30 a.m., something disturbed Brooke's peaceful slumber. She was awoken by sounds of fighting. The sounds were out of place for where the girl found herself. Her grandmother lived alone, so why would she be fighting with a man in the middle of the night? Scared and confused, Brooke crept down the hallway to see what was the matter. When she got into the kitchen, she saw a man screaming at her grandmother, and her grandmother screaming back at him. She thought that the man had something in his hand, but she didn't know what it was. The whole situation seemed bad and violent. Even more frightened at that point, Brooke turned and ran as fast as her tiny legs could carry her back to the bedroom, where she thought to hide from the angry man. As she moved, she heard another sound, one even more terrifying than her grandmother's screams, the thudding footsteps of the man behind her.
Oh my God, this is terrifying. She's only 6 years old.
Only six.
By the way, can I just say that this is probably my biggest fear now that I'm a parent? I'm sure you feel the same way, where it's like...
The whole time.
You know, like, I mean, this could happen in our, you know, our presence, but imagine as parents, you leave your daughter with your grandma thinking she's safe, you know, and now this is happening. That's terrifying. Anyway, I'm sorry. Well,
they're both very vulnerable if you think about it. So you have, I mean, she's 58, so she's a very young grandmother, but she's still 58, so she's very vulnerable. As is a six-year-old. So these are two of the most vulnerable age groups in our society. And it's very scary when you actually think about the situation if it were to arise. Well, Brooke made it into the bedroom and jumped into the bed and did what every child does to hide from a monster. She covered herself with the blankets. For a second, it was quiet, but then the covers that shielded her were yanked away, and she saw the man from the kitchen come at her, and her world faded to black. Miraculously, the next morning, Brooke Sutton opened her eyes. She was in unimaginable pain. She didn't know what had happened to her or why, but when she looked down at herself, she found her body battered, bruised, and covered in blood. She had a cut on her throat that had bled all over her, but it wasn't deep enough to have killed her. At 6 years old, Brooke had been brutalized in ways that she couldn't yet understand. All she knew was how bad parts of her hurt. Tentatively, she limped down the hallway again, a journey she once enjoyed but now feared. She hoped that the man had left because she wanted to find her grandmother to see if she was all right. And probably if she could help her, like she always did if she got hurt. When Brooke made it into the kitchen, she found her grandmother on the floor. To an adult, it would have been very obvious that Judith Johnson, or Judy as her friends called her, had been savagely murdered. However, her six-year-old granddaughter just thought that maybe she'd gone to sleep and that she would wake up just as she had. At first, she tried to wake her gently, but when that didn't work, she tried to shake her and yell. But still, that did not work. It was then that it clicked in her mind that her grandmother was dead, a concept she had only distantly heard about up until that point in her life, and the realization was a crushing one. Brooke did not know what to do. Her mother was not there and would not be able to get back to her grandmother's as quickly as she needed her to. So the girl thought to call her grandmother's friend, June, who lived very nearby. Unfortunately, June did not pick up the phone. In a quiet, squeaky voice, six-year-old Brooke left one of the most heartbreaking voicemails you will ever hear. On the recording, she could be heard saying, "I'm sorry to tell you this, but my grandma died, and I need somebody to get my mom for me. I'm all alone. Somebody killed my grandma. Now, please, would you get a hold of me as soon as you can? Bye."
This is so sad.
So devastating that she's having to deal with these situations and figure out what to do. When there was no call back, Brooke knew that she should go get help. She decided to go to her grandmother's neighbor's house, two doors down, which was located at 116 Summit Street. It was the home of 26-year-old Tanya Brazel and her three daughters. Now, I think the reason why she felt comfortable going there was because Brooke, on a regular basis, when she would go to her grandmother's house, would play with these three girls because they were around her age.
Okay, so it was something familiar.
Yes.
Yeah, but what a smart girl to know to do that, to do these things.
I know.
Oh, my God.
And she had been taught to call 911 if it was an emergency, but what I can imagine was her brain was a bit confused because technically this wasn't, she didn't know this was an emergency to call 911 for, because she didn't know how to handle a death because she's 6 years old. And she wasn't thinking about herself. She's only thinking about her grandmother.
It's so sad. You're making me so sad already.
I know. I apologize.
Why do you do this to us?
Just 10 minutes in, breaking hearts.
I know. You are. Okay, the heartbreaker.
That's me. When Tanya came to the door, Brooke explained that someone had murdered her grandmother and asked if she could have a ride back home to be with her mother. Tanya looked at the beaten, bruised, and cut 6-year-old on her doorstep, this mother of three, and listened to what she had to say. And then she told Brooke to wait outside because she needed to feed her daughter's breakfast. She made Brooke sit and wait on her front porch for a long period of time. Now, I've heard this period of time be talked about differently. Some accounts say 10 minutes and other accounts say 45 minutes. In later interviews, Brooke says 45 minutes.
So that's a little odd.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just start off by saying that. Though we have to try to understand one thing. I don't want to make an excuse, but if a child or an adult came to your door covered in blood, and you know you're trying to process that situation, you know, as best you can, because you don't know, is the attacker still there? What's going on? I don't think the human brain has the ability in a split second that to understand such a tragedy. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think everybody goes into action right away. Like, everybody would think that they would react, is what I'm saying.
Well, would, if a girl came to our door covered in blood, clearly beaten up, bruises all over her in a nightgown.
Yeah.
Saying, somebody killed my grandmother. And she's calm, meaning that there's no pursuer there. What would be the first thing that you did?
Well, here's the thing, right? We would all say what we would want to do. Me, personally, I would let her in.
And do what?
I'd let her in. I'd call 911. And then I would look to, you know, just sit her down, try to calm her down and be there for her.
Well, this woman does not let her in her house ever. She makes her sit on the front porch.
That's wild.
For a long period of time.
That's wild.
Think about what this girl's already been through, trying to get in contact with people. Finally, she drives Brooke back to her mother's house. She briefly speaks to April before driving off, allowing the two to finally, you know, be together.
I think it's very bizarre. But I'm just trying to say that, you know, to understand what might be happening, you're not sure. You have your own kids to protect. I'm sure some of these weird things go through your mind, but I would like to believe that the human thing to do is to take that child in and take care of her and call the cops. But I'm just saying, some people's brain might not trigger that way. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, just imagine this poor 6-year-old girl, her grandmother dead. She was brutalized herself, and she's begging for an ounce of comfort, and she didn't get it.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't know.
But finally, she was home. April Sutton, who is Brooke's mother, explains in an interview with Dateline back in 2007 that she was shocked when she opened the front door. She never would have expected her six-year-old to be the one there because she thought she was at her mother's house. But she was, and she said she hardly recognized her. She was covered head to toe in blood. She had bruises and a haunted look about her. Brooke wasted no time. She explained everything to her mother. April recalled Brooke was trying to tell her something about her mother, but the scene was so surreal to her that it was hard to process anything. However, she understood that something bad had to have happened in order for Brooke to be covered in blood and on her doorstep. So she sent her husband over to her mother's house to see what had happened. When Brooke's father arrived at Judith's house, he found her, just as Brooke said he would. He called 911. The conversation's recording was as follows. My mother-in-law has been stabbed. My little girl spent the night here, and the neighbor just brought her home and said that my mother-in-law was lying on the floor dead. And I come up here and she's lying here on the floor. Oh my God. What's that? The 911 operator said. She's dead, he concluded, and gave the address. Back at their house, Brooke's mother asked her again to slowly explain what happened. She knew she would have to call the police herself and take her daughter to the hospital. She could tell that something awful had happened to her. Who did this? April asked her daughter. Did you see what he looked like? The traumatized and exhausted six-year-old did offer an answer. And this is what April had also been told by the neighbor, but she couldn't comprehend what was happening yet. And Brooke said to her mother something along the lines of, he looked like or sounded like Uncle Clarence. Well, April was in absolute shock. Clarence was the husband of her older sister, Melinda.
Okay. Okay, so she's claiming a family member did this.
Yes. Because Melinda was 10 years older than April, she had always been like a second mother to her. And when she started dating Clarence, April was only 7 years old. So she had always seen him as this amazing big brother, father figure type. She knew that Melinda and Clarence had their problems in their relationship, but to her, he'd always been amazing. And she knew him only to be a good father to the two sons that he shared with her sister. But this was her daughter, soaked in blood, saying that the man looked and sounded like Clarence. So to her, there was only one thing to do. Believe her. The woman that had dropped off Brooke also mentioned to April before she left that Brooke said that she believed the man that had done this looked like her Uncle Clarence. So this was something that Brooke also repeated to the first adult that she was able to speak to on the car ride home. Now, back at the crime scene, detectives had arrived to find the forensic analysts doing everything they could to find evidence throughout the house. There had clearly been a struggle all throughout the living room and kitchen area. It would later be determined that 58-year-old Judith Johnson had been attacked while she had slept on the couch in the living room. When Brooke's father, and then later first responders, crime scene techs, and the detectives saw what happened to her, they were appalled. How could a human being do that to another? Then their thoughts went to Brooke. After the terror that she survived, the brutality she suffered, to have to wake up and find your grandmother the way that she had must have been a true devastation, and a sickening discovery of that kind of evil at such a young age must have been so impactful to her psyche. Because Judith had been severely beaten. She had fractures to her skull, jaw, nose, and collarbone. It was almost impossible to identify her facial features. Brooke must have known it was her from her hair and her nightgown.
You know, when you see something like that, you do think, okay, what possible motive can somebody have off the street to do that? And if it is... the uncle here, like, it's being claimed, seriously, then what could it be? Is it a money thing? Is it like, you know, maybe he was, you know, told that he was being left something, you know, is this person maybe a little unhinged, maybe on drugs and is looking for money? Like, there's a lot of things here that it could be.
Well, there's more to the attack.
Okay.
Judith had also been brutally raped and sodomized. During the sexual assault exam that was performed on Judith during her autopsy, two hairs had been found on her body in her anal region that would later be determined to not match her hairs. They were determined to be a head hair and a pubic hair. Now, during the examination of Brooke's nightgown from that night, the night she was attacked, they also found a hair, and this hair matched the hair found on her grandmother. Judith's official cause of death was determined to be strangulation. Now, some sources say that she was stabbed and others do not. So I don't want to definitively say one or the other, but I think it's more reliable to say that she had also suffered from stab wounds, but that her immediate cause of death was strangulation. And the reason why I think she suffered from stab wounds is because when Brooke's father discovers her, he mentions them on the 911 call. And also we know that the attacker most likely had a knife because Brooke had seen something in his hand while he was attacking her grandmother, and because her neck also had been cut.
But I don't understand. What did the ME conclude, though?
Strangulation was the cause of death.
Right.
But I couldn't find, I don't have the whole results of the autopsy report.
I see.
So I don't know if there was a reported stabbing, and some reports say it was, she was just strangled and raped.
I see what you're saying.
Or so others we just say don't wanna... strangled, raped, and stabbed. So I just want to mention that there's kind of conflicting accounts out there, all from reliable sources, which is confusing. But I think because the 911 call and Brooke's cut and her seeing something in the hand, we could say that there was probably stab wounds, but they were more superficial than they were like wounds that were intended to kill. I think it seems like this is rooted in deep anger, maybe something personal, because we know that, I mean, stabbing and strangulation, both, you have to be up close and personal. And that's kind of what we found that it alludes to, like a personal killing. But it seems like strangulation was what this person did while the sexual assault was taking place. And it eventually ended in her death.
Well, now that you're saying that there was sexual assault involved, like his goal was to sexually assault somebody, because beating and strangulation, like you said, is personal, but sometimes can be used because if someone's obviously someone's fighting for their life, they're fighting.
And she was.
Right. So they're fighting for their life. They're fighting to get somebody off of them if a rape is in progress. Right. So it's I don't want to say it's normal, but obviously in a scuffle like this, to try to survive, this person's beating them and strangling them while that's being done.
Well, we know, though, also that this is what that person wants to do.
Right.
Because Brooke is, and it'll be revealed later, she was first knocked unconscious.
Okay.
And then she was beaten and raped.
The 6-year-old as well?
Yes.
So both of them?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right.
So once the scene had been observed and the body removed, the detectives that had been assigned to the case made it to the hospital where Brooke Sutton, their only witness to the attack, was being treated for her wounds. It was determined by a sexual assault exam that Brooke had been assaulted in the same ways her grandmother had been. She had been knocked unconscious by her attacker, brutally raped and strangled, even though she was unconscious. At one point, she had sustained a cut on her neck, but because she had passed out during the attack first, Brooke could not say how she definitively got it. The killer must have thought Brooke to be dead, but he was unaware that she had only passed out, which was the only reason she survived.
So this person's an animal, right? I will say this. I know she said it sounded and looked like her uncle, but I'll tell you what, that accusation, I feel like would, you know, it's going to really hurt this family.
Oh, it's going to tear them apart.
I mean, how could it not, right? Like, it's just going to be bad. I mean, I hope that we can find some evidence to either definitively say, yes, it was the uncle to put him away if it is him. But if not, we want to exonerate him not only in a court of law, but also to the family, because you don't want that to be a thing.
Right.
Right.
And we do have DNA evidence, which is good.
Okay. That's cool.
At this point, everyone who was at the hospital to be there for Brooke had heard that Clarence had done this to them, to their family. At first, they were confused, then out for blood, when they heard what happened to the 6-year-old girl and her 58-year-old grandmother, two helpless victims that had been unable to protect themselves or each other. When the detectives came to question Brooke in April, they were told just as much, that Clarence had been the man who had committed the crimes. Brooke was quiet and withdrawn, which was typical behavior from someone who had just gone through what she had. So the detectives took much of their direction from April. Just a few hours later, the detectives, aided by other deputies from Summit County Sheriff's Department, made the 40-minute drive from Babberton to the home of Melinda and Clarence Elkins in Louisville, Ohio, with an arrest warrant in hand. At that point, Melinda had not even been informed that her mother had been murdered or that her niece had been attacked and left for dead. When the police descended upon the home, Clarence went to see what was wrong. He left out the family's back door and was promptly swarmed by a SWAT team. A wave of confusion swept up the family. Melinda asked what happened while Clarence was being dragged away, asking the same question. That was how Melinda had found out what had happened in the early morning hours of June 7th. And in that one moment, she lost both her mother and her husband. Melinda said that she was in disbelief. The first thing she did was double over when she heard that her mother had been murdered. She was so close with Judith. She felt she owed her her life, as she had been adopted by the Johnson family. Now, interestingly enough, and this is a side note, Melinda had been a Hicks baby. A Hicks baby was the term given to over 200 infants who were illegally sold on the black market during the 1950s and 60s by Dr. Thomas Doc Hicks in McKaysville, Georgia. He frequently falsified birth certificates and in some cases told birth mothers that their babies had died and he actually sold them to other families.
Are you kidding me?
Yes. There's a lot of documentaries on this case, but Melinda is one of those Hicks babies. And she was bought by Judith and her husband. But this is, you know, something that they were always very honest with Melinda about.
Wow.
Yeah. So the second thing she did was deny that Clarence had any involvement. Next, she ran into the house and away from the detective she spoke to call her grandmother to see if it was all true. An uncle of Melinda's picked up the phone instead. When she asked if it was true, he confirmed it was. Her mother had been murdered, and Brooke had said that it had been Clarence who did it. At the police station, 35-year-old Clarence Elkins was in a state of utter disbelief, which made it very difficult for him to answer the questions the detectives asked him. He had been processed and informed that he was being charged with murder, attempted murder, 2 counts of rape, and felonious assault. In an interrogation room, he was grilled about what had happened the night of June 6th. He could barely answer the questions because all he could think about was the fact that his mother-in-law was dead and Brooke had been attacked. And she said it had been him who did it. Brooke was close to them. She was like one of his own children. He just couldn't comprehend why she would say that he had done this.
I mean, could it possibly be a lookalike? I mean, she is, look, this isn't to downplay a victim, especially a 6-year-old victim. I'm not doing that. I'm just trying to say, you know, could it be someone that maybe looked like him a little bit? You know, I mean,
she's a 6-year-old who's gone through a lot of trauma. And one argument could be here is that a six-year-old has a very insular world, meaning there's only a certain amount of people that she's seen over and over again in her life. So the fact that when she's trying to figure out who someone is, she's relating what they look like to someone she knows very well in her life is very much a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest with you. I would be thrown. I mean, imagine that curveball that you're being accused of such a horrendous crime.
Yeah.
To your family, no less. So, like, I kind of want to be on board. I hope that he's innocent. You know, I really do. But I also want to believe. I want to believe this girl and get the right person. So, this is very complicated.
And that's also the situation that her mother was in as well.
Yeah.
Like she's going to 100% believe her daughter, which is a relief and very refreshing.
Absolutely.
In the true crime world, but also scary,
right,
and confusing for her mother.
You get what I'm trying to say, though, like
100%.
You know,
don't you worry.
OK, just make a trip.
Clarence had told the detectives that he had been at several bars the night of June 6th into the early morning hours of June 7th. He said he returned back home at 3 a.m., something that was later confirmed by Melinda at the family's home, which is located in Magnolia, Ohio, which is 40 miles away from Judith Johnson's house. So he's claiming to be 45 minutes away from Barberton the whole time. So he pleaded with the detectives to believe him, that this all had to be one massive misunderstanding, but they were not listening to him. The detectives did speak to the people that Clarence claimed to have been with that night. One of those witnesses was a woman named Sue Dalton. She said that she had been with Clarence for a large portion of the night, and that it would have been impossible for him to have physically done it, but she also added that she didn't think that he would have anything to do with it anyway. According to her, the officer that was questioning her said, "Well, we got our man. We know for a fact that we have our man." And when she continued to say that she didn't believe that Clarence would have committed this crime, she reported that the officer told her that if she didn't distance herself from Clarence, that she'd end up in jail too.
Well, that's a ride or die. Wow. Yeah, this is tough. Because, okay, so now we're also getting this feeling from police that it's just a horse blinder investigation.
Which is unfortunate.
It's unfortunate. And, you know, I'm glad at least that there is DNA evidence here, or we would be dealing with a different set of circumstances, I think.
Well, samples of hair, DNA, and fingerprints were taken from Clarence. And despite the fact that his hair sample was not a match for the hairs found on Judith Johnson or Brooke Sutton's nightgown, the Summit County prosecutors continued to pursue charges against him.
Why? Like, I'm not saying let the man go, I'm not saying let the man go free, but I mean, come on, we're wasting valuable resources and time. Right now, instead of saying, nope, we're going to keep pursuing, the turnaround should be, okay, we have DNA evidence. Is CODIS out by this time? I always forget this.
It's out, but it's very restricted, and meaning that like a lot of places aren't being forced to enter in data. So it's very, very new.
Okay. But we could still, in this case, utilize it, right?
But if the state of Ohio hasn't input it there, data, then it wouldn't matter. But they do know it doesn't match, so CODIS doesn't even matter.
I guess you're right. I just don't know why we would want to railroad somebody for something that if they didn't do it, you know, and I hate that about our system, you know. But once again, we are in the need to protect a six-year-old girl and someone that has been killed. I just, like I said, I want to get to the right person, not just is that possible? You know, like, is this the right guy?
I understand. Well, the Summit County investigators were hell-bent on finding physical evidence to corroborate their eyewitness testimony, their victim's testimony, and they spared no expense in trying to do so. Clarence's vehicle had been taken in as evidence and scoured for blood, hair, or fibers, but none were ever found. Based on the attack that had been carried out on the victims, the detectives were told that the attacker would have also had blood all over them. Thinking that Clarence had gone home and showered after the attacks made them search his entire home and the drains of his shower to see if they could find any evidence that had been washed away. And still, they found nothing. Clarence was also brought in for a lineup that was shown to Brooke, and the detectives matched the others in the lineup to the appearance of Clarence rather than the actual description that Brooke had given. And of course, she picked him. However, no matter who they put in that lineup, she was going to pick her uncle because she was six, and he was the only person that she was familiar with. And by that point, everyone had She told people that it was Uncle Clarence. So if everyone in her life is believing her and believing that this is Uncle Clarence, it's only going to be this perpetuation of this accusation.
Not to mention the more time that passes with that family being involved and talking to her every night, her memory is going to be a little skewed now.
100%, especially because of the trauma that she suffered, especially a head trauma. The only evidence they had was the eyewitness testimony of six-year-old Brooke Sutton, his niece, working against Clarence Elkins. He maintained that he did not do it. But the accusation and the not guilty plea of the 35-year-old tore the family apart. Melinda believed her husband, as did their young sons, that Clarence had not and could not have committed the murder or the attack, both because they knew and loved him and because he had been home that night. They steadfastly stood by him throughout the trial. All the others in the family believed that he had done it. They believed Brooke and April. And the brutality of the crime, the worst things that could be done to a person, they were done to a helpless grandmother and her six-year-old granddaughter. It added an extra element to this matter, and the other members of the family weren't just convinced of Clarence's guilt, they were disgusted and furious with him, and by extension, Melinda, because she was defending him. It's really hard in this situation to not understand how the other family members are feeling, or April. If your daughter came home to you like that, witnessed that, told you that story and said, I know who did it, and you found out what was done to your daughter, you would be just as angry and just as defensive of her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, like we said earlier, this is going to tear them apart. How could you look Clarence in the face or anybody else that would side with him in the face? And I think it's actually funny because even as we're going through this case right now, like live pretty much, I feel almost bad even suggesting that it's not him, right? Like, I want to just full on just be like, nope, he's, that's it. Like,
so you want justice for her.
Because I want justice for her. But I think that this case, there's more to it than what meets the eye. There has to be.
Right.
I don't know this guy from Adam, but it doesn't seem to me like he would do that.
Well, if he has an alibi and the hairs don't match him, but the hairs match each other, meaning the same hair was found on Brooke as was her grandmother, then we have to assume those hairs came from the attacker. And if they don't match him and his alibi checks out, both from outside people and his family, and he was 45 minutes away, logistically he couldn't do it, it's very confusing.
It is. No, it really is.
But they're looking at the emotionality of it, which is obviously the very easy thing to do here. At the trial, Brooke identified her Uncle Clarence as the man that had been there that night. She said it had been him, and she had heard his voice. In addition to this, a friend of Judith's testified that she had been over Judith's house when she received a call from Clarence. So Clarence is calling his mother-in-law, Judith Johnson. He had been angry and accused Judith of getting involved in his marriage. He then threatened her, saying that if she ever did that again, that he would kill her. It was explained by this friend that Clarence and Melinda had a very off again, on again relationship, as they'd gotten together as kids, so young, 17. And Clarence didn't like how involved Judith was and how much Melinda shared with her mother. And there ended the evidence against Clarence. He had made a threat, and Brooke was identifying him as the man who had done it that night.
Right, so now we're injecting now also an additional motive of you're getting involved in my business, stay out.
Right.
But I mean, for some families, you know, they do draw a line, and sometimes people don't listen.
Don't have boundaries. And yeah.
Right. So,
but that there's a difference between being mad at your mother-in-law for interfering in your marriage and then committing that violent of an offense against her. And then not just her, but then also your niece who was present at the time.
Exactly. And you took the words right out of my mouth. They don't correlate. I mean, there should never be like that kind of correlation. But what I'm saying is that kind of motive does not match up with the crime, period.
Right.
It just doesn't. You know, if anything, it would just be a physical violent or killing, and that's it. There would be no rape involved. And also, why would you attack a six-year-old that has nothing to do with it at all?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Now, when it came to his defense, there was a lot. Melinda testified that her husband had come home around 3 a.m., making it impossible for him to have been there at the time of the murder. Because if you remember, they're saying that the time that the murderer arrived at the house was between 2 and 2:30 a.m., but he arrived home at 3 a.m., 45 minutes away from the crime scene. Those he was with at the bars that night also testified that he was with them. And physically, the hairs found on the victims did not match his hairs. It was also told that Clarence had no criminal history and no history of violence. The trial came down to emotion and reason for the jurors. Which were they going to choose? They heard the harrowing tale that young Brooke told. She was just 7, and their hearts broke for her. And then they heard from the defense, a team that told them to erase that heartache and consider the facts. And the fact that Brooke, maybe being 6, having such an insular world, as I said, and having gone through a traumatic experience, may have simply misremembered or filled in gaps of her memory that were missing with other memories that exist in her brain, which we know is how human memory works.
Same thing within that preschool stuff with the demonic worship stuff.
Well, that's more like groupthink and like catching on to what other people are saying. I think what's happening here is a more realistic thing that happens all the time, and it's a lot more scientific than that, where people have holes in their memories because one of the most unreliable things in your life is your memory. You might not think so because it belongs to you, but it is. And when there are pieces of your memory missing, what you do is you fill in those pieces with other aspects of memory. So she might not remember what this man looks like, but she does remember her Uncle Clarence's face. And if he's around the same age as this person that did it, her memory, even if she's not cognizant of it happening, is filling in that gap. And that's what was explained to the jurors. Like, this is what happens with memory. And we know the most unreliable victims are eyewitnesses, especially ones who have gone through trauma and traumatic brain injury. So maybe Clarence Elkins, the man that had no criminal record, no history of violence, had just simply not done it. Well, on June 4th, 1999, 2 days shy of 1 year since the murder and attack, the jury came back with their decision. They found Clarence Elkins guilty of aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, 2 counts of rape, and felonious assault.
Wow.
He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Like I said, if he did it, good. Like, I'm glad now he's got like locked away, but can we say for certain? I just feel like that's an injustice. It really is. Like, I don't... That doesn't do anything for the memory of Judith or help with the family of Brooke and Brooke.
Right. Well, like, and the fact that the evidence just wasn't there. I mean, they have two pieces of evidence, a threatening phone call that he made and Brooke's eyewitness testimony. Now, that carries a lot of weight. I'm not negating that fact, but the physical evidence actually points away from him.
It does.
As does his alibi.
It truly does.
I'm shocked at that conviction, especially in 1999.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I speak from a good place. I want justice for our victims. But it doesn't sound like this is the person that did it. And I just can't stand behind it. I'm just steadfast in this. I don't know why. I don't think there's anything that I've heard so far in, you know, almost an hour here, you know, that right. would indicate that he did it. And I can't follow that. So I don't know how a jury of his peers can find him guilty and how a judge could be like, yeah, you know what? Yeah, he's guilty. Like, how?
Well, a judge doesn't make that decision.
I know, but he's sitting there.
But did you know? Sentence him.
Right. He sentenced him to the harshest, he threw the book at him on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, man. Like, how are you going to sit? How can any juror sit there and be like, but yeah, also, there's enough there for me?
Because they sat there and they listened to Brooke explain what happened, as I did in the beginning.
Yeah. It's strong.
And they heard that voicemail and they saw the brutality that both women faced, and they couldn't not hold someone responsible.
Right, but in a way, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, okay, but like, in a way, isn't that almost groupthink? If you got a whole entire jury sitting in a room after listening to that, if one or two people are saying, yeah, did you hear that voicemail? Wasn't that heartbreaking? Or, you know, wouldn't eventually they would all just get on board with that?
I completely agree with you. I think that it's, and even more than that, they're using emotions and not reason,
right,
which goes against what they're supposed to be doing as a jury. And that's why I'm a little surprised that Clarence Elkins' attorneys didn't ask for a judge trial, not a jury trial.
I wouldn't want a jury trial on this because right. I feel like there is too much emotion and too much pain that has been inflicted to a six-year-old child and another woman that I don't think that any person in a jury could look at it factually.
Right.
It's impossible.
Well, at the reading of the verdict, Clarence crumbled and Melinda broke down. She placed her head on the table before her in defeat. She remembered thinking that she was so upset that she was going to die. She then leapt up and looked at her sister April, Brooke's mother, and said, "You know he didn't do this." Before her sister could respond, Melinda turned to Clarence, who was being taken away by the deputy, and said, "I love you." And the two exchanged their last "I love yous," and he was taken away.
That's sad.
Well, last "I love yous" face to face. Now, after the trial, life was very difficult for Melinda. She had to raise and support two children on her own. Because things had been so hard, she had to sell the home that they lived in with her husband and moved with the boys about a dozen different times to help keep costs low and move where the jobs were. While she worked hard to raise the boys, she had to stay in good spirits for them and also Clarence. She worked two jobs and homeschooled the children because of how they were treated in school. And when she wasn't doing those things, she worked on her husband's case. She fully supported him and backed him 100% of the way when it came to his appeals. She was determined to prove his innocence and get him out of jail. Another reason why money was tight was because she was paying for Clarence's new attorneys. But the hardest part of it all was that she had to do it on her own. Melinda had been so close to her mother and sister, and now her mother had been murdered and her sister blamed her husband for it. She felt so alone. From 1999 to 2002, Clarence had two appeals and lost them both. It was at that time that Melinda hired a private investigator to help her with her husband's case. For 3 years, Melinda and her sister did not speak, and Melinda said that it hurt her also because she knew that her sister and niece were suffering as well. They'd also lost Judith, and Brooke had been horrifically attacked. She and Clarence maintained that they were never upset with Brooke about pointing the finger at him. Rather, they thought that she had been a terrified six-year-old girl that had seen a man in the dark and simply gotten confused. So in 2002, Melinda just couldn't take the silence anymore. She just knew that she wanted to be back in her family's lives, and vice versa. She wanted them in hers, and she would never be able to prove Clarence's innocence without them. And she knew deep down they wanted to know what really happened as well, just like she did. So she decided to take bold action, and she just showed up at April's house one day.
Wow. Okay. How'd that go?
Well, Melinda said that April's husband answered the door, and she asked if she could come in. He agreed. When April came out and saw Melinda was there, she said she walked away at first, which made her heart sink. But then her sister turned around, and the two immediately embraced each other, washing away the past 3 years in an instant. The sisters cried in each other's arms, and no words needed to be spoken between them. Melinda and April were both grateful that their first encounter with each other had gone the way it did. They missed each other. And moreover, they knew the kids had missed each other because the cousins had always been quite close. Eventually, and carefully, Melinda broached the topic of what happened 4 years prior and the subsequent trial and appeals with April. Melinda explained to her that she knew Clarence had not done it, and that she wanted to get justice for their mother and for Brooke. April had to admit that she always had doubts in her mind about Clarence having done it, because she knew him since she was 7, and she couldn't see him doing this either. She said she would always stand by her daughter, but she was going to stand by her sister as well. And together they promised to get to the bottom of what truly happened on that June night. But she made clear to Melinda that if it still points to Clarence, like, it's him. Like, I'm not going to be blind to either side, but once we know, like, that's what it is.
Right. And I have to give them credit for that, actually, because that is a big step. Most people, I feel like, probably wouldn't do what they did, both of them.
Right.
You know, by one approaching the other and just letting your guard down completely and being able to embrace, that's not an easy thing to do.
No, I completely agree. But I think that also speaks to how close the family was and how much they all really knew each other.
But it also indicates that there's a possibility that maybe deep down they had a feeling that it wasn't right. I feel like they had to have, or that wouldn't have even happened.
I agree.
You know?
Brooke began spending more time with her cousins, Melinda's sons. And Brooke explained in an interview that it was during one of their play dates together that she realized she really made the mistake, because she'd always had her doubts. In interviews that Brooke has given since she was older, she stated that she always doubted whether or not her Uncle Clarence could have been the man that was at her grandmother's house that night. She said that when she was asked by everyone who had done it, she said the man sounded like Clarence. He had the same body shape as him. He looked like him. And from there, it kind of morphed into really having been Clarence. And the momentum that picked up speed from everyone in the family then being up in arms, talking about it, Brooke could do nothing but run with it. Even though she truly did have doubts, she said that even while she was on the stand during that first trial, she was like, she really didn't know, but that's what she was supposed to say. That's what she knew. And as the consequences of the accusation played out, the larger and larger the seeds of doubt began to grow in her mind. Like, once he was put away in jail, she was kind of upset. And this was always an unbearable weight the young girl carried. Another burden to add to the others, as she also bore the weight of surviving an attack that her grandmother had not, and having suffered such a brutal and devastating sexual assault at 6 years old. It had stripped her of every ounce of her childhood, and she also had the burden of her accusation on top as well. And you have to think about what that must have done emotionally to Brooke Sutton. And that's, it's really sad to think about.
It is. And I think it is easy for her to fall to the wayside when you're talking about this case, you know, because there's just so many moving pieces. But yeah, I mean, that is a lot to handle. And I feel terrible for her.
Right. Well, while she was playing with her cousins in the garage one day, she saw hanging a collage that they had made of their father. It had been years since she had seen her uncle. So Brooke stopped to look at it, to see if she could remember anything. The images didn't conjure up any memories. However, she did notice something interesting. She said that in those pictures, she saw that Clarence had blue eyes. She had remembered something about the attack. About the man who had come at her, just how unbelievably dark his eyes had been. The killer had brown eyes.
That is a big difference. Yeah.
So Brooke told Melinda, who she called Aunt Mindy, about this revelation. At this point, Brooke was 10 years old, and she stood steadfast in the belief that she had gotten it wrong for 4 years. And that she didn't know who the killer was. That it hadn't been her Uncle Clarence. She had just gone with something that she shouldn't have, and she deeply regretted it. But what was she to do at 6 years old? Brooke and her family, including Melinda, contacted the prosecutor's office to let them know the news. The only real piece of evidence they had against Clarence had been wrong. He was innocent. After hearing what the family had to say, the prosecutors made the decision to not vacate the verdict and sentencing of Clarence Elkins. And later a judge would say the same thing. The trial that Melinda had petitioned for based on the recanting of the only eyewitness and the only evidence they had against her husband had been denied. It's a very interesting thing here. So I understand on one hand where they're saying, okay, a witness can't just say I changed my mind and poof, someone is out of jail. But that's also what you did to put him in jail.
If it was the strongest piece of evidence to get him in, it should be the strongest piece of evidence to get him out.
Right.
You know?
Or at least get him another trial.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But nothing would stop Melinda from proving her husband's innocence. She made that clear through both her words and actions. The only option she had at that point was to conduct her own investigation. If she could hand a viable suspect to the Summit County Prosecutor's Office, a suspect on a silver platter, maybe they would pay attention. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but I think what I'm going to tell everyone next speaks to a part of us that we all understand because, after all, here you are listening to a true crime podcast, which, by the way, we thank you endlessly for. So Melinda figured out what to do next from all the crime shows that she watched on television.
Okay.
So it made sense, right? She has to launch her own investigation. So it was through the shows that she figured out which direction to go into. The first thing she did was begin a suspect list. She wanted to understand who could do this. It had not been her husband with zero history of violence, but maybe there was someone with a history like that that may have noticed that the windows and doors were opened and committed a crime of opportunity. So she figured that a list would be a good place to start. And if you ask me, it would have been a great place for the Barberton Police Department to start, or the Summit County Sheriff's Department to start, but they didn't. They went directly to Clarence, and they never even looked into other people with violent histories in the area.
I mean, that's, there's really no excuse for it. I got nothing.
Now, don't get me wrong. All of us true crime aficionados and armchair detectives are amazing. But Melinda knew she was a bit out of her league. The wheels of justice turn slowly and could also crush you, which she had found out the hard way. So she needed some expert legal advice as well. And this is in addition also to the private investigator that she was working with. And she was doing all of this on and off. So she would get tasks to do by the private investigator because she couldn't really afford for them to do it themselves, which would make that task go faster. So she would then, you know, compile it on her own time. And money was tight. So, I mean, that makes sense. She was satisfied with the current counsel her husband had. However, she thought it would be useful if she sought the help of an expert on wrongful convictions, which is then what's going to allow the Ohio Innocence Project to get involved. Together, they found out a lot of troubling information from poring through case files and following up with some people, statements and evidence, because now she has law students working on this through an Innocence Project. The first thing they discovered was the fact that the other key witness for the prosecution, the friend of Judith that said Clarence had threatened her life, had said on the stand that after Clarence had done this, Judith took the call and the threat seriously and placed a call to 911, something that she said she was there for. However, when they looked at 911 call logs from that very day, there was no claim. Judith had never called to report a threat that Clarence had made. Now, if this were to have been known by Clarence's defense team, they could have poked holes in her testimony and created reasonable doubt on the second piece of evidence that they had against their client. And this would call into question the legitimacy or seriousness of her claim. The second thing they discovered was a possible suspect from a list they compiled. And the third thing they discovered, which was a shock and would help them tremendously, was a piece of DNA that had never been tested.
You're joking.
No. During Judy Johnson's autopsy, a sexual assault exam was performed. When the coroner took a vaginal swab from the victim, they found a substance called acid phosphatase, which is an enzyme found in the male prostate gland, which meant that it had to have come from the attacker.
Okay.
The swab was never tested.
So now you have all these years that have gone by and that's just never, that's just been sitting there the whole time.
It's been sitting there, but luckily it's been properly preserved.
Okay, well that's good.
Melinda and the private investigator, a man by the name of Martin Yant, who worked a lot with the Ohio Innocence Project, wanted to test the DNA of their suspect against the DNA found during the autopsy. There was also another piece of DNA that was found that wasn't tested, and this was later determined. It was in the underwear of Brooke Sutton, and it was a skin cell that belonged to a male. However, they wanted to focus on the vaginal swab because skin cells are really tricky because they're very easily transferable. So like, for instance, like if someone was folding her underwear, folding the laundry, a skin cell could transfer. So the stronger proof would come from the vaginal swab because it meant that that person would have had to have been sexually assaulting Judy Johnson for that substance to be found in her body.
Right. Which makes sense because that's actual evidence that we could test and get a hit on if it came up.
Right. And now at this point, compare it to the hairs that were found.
Yeah. Because now it's, you know, a couple years later.
Melinda, with the help of the lawyers and investigators she hired, petitioned the court to test the DNA. What helped them was the fact that Brooke Sutton had also recanted her testimony. So they are going to get the retesting of the DNA, and they are going to hear the testimony of Brooke Sutton again, who was now claiming that it wasn't her uncle, but this other man that they were suspecting. So they're really like honing in on this one guy, and they really think that it's him. So they're going to compare his DNA to the substance found on the vaginal swab. Now, the court allowed for this testing, especially after this suspect, this third party, agreed to submit his DNA voluntarily to exonerate himself, he said. Now, it took weeks for the results to come back. And when they did, Melinda learned that she had to take the good with the bad. First, she learned that the man that she thought was the man that attacked and killed her mother and attacked her niece was, in fact, not the man who did it. This guy that they were banking on, his DNA didn't match. However, the good news was that she also learned that Clarence's DNA did not match the substance found on the vaginal swab, meaning that he had not done it. But the adamancy of Brooke that this had been this man showed that her testimony was not going to be helpful in court, because she had been so adamant that it had been Clarence when she was six. And now at this second hearing, she's so adamant that it was this third guy. And on top of it, I don't know why they went this route, but they had Brooke hypnotized. And they were claiming that under hypnosis is when she realized that it was this man instead of her uncle. So it's looking like it's kind of like, I don't want to call it a bit of a circus, but I think the inclusion of the hypnosis and the fact that we're now making this second adamant accusation and then it's proven to be false is making her look unreliable and showing that her memory of that night was skewed. But what's wild here is this, is that if they're saying that Brooke's account is unreliable and the DNA is enough to keep this second man out of jail, then why isn't it enough to keep Clarence out of jail?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to say. It's just weird. Nothing makes sense. And I just don't know how that could be done.
Right.
You know?
I think what really hurt them here is that the hypnosis account really seemed to be and was interpreted by the court to be more of like a fictionalized account of what happened that night. I also found the name of the man that they accused, but because it turned out not to be him, I figured it's best not to mention it again. So although they found out that Clarence had not been the killer through DNA testing a second time, the court denied a petition for a new trial on the grounds that the DNA results were unreliable because the swab may have been contaminated during transportation of a third-party testing.
If that's the case, you can make that argument about any case that has been done with DNA.
Or they should have tested the DNA then.
But if we know that, it's been properly sealed and kept...
No, they're saying that... So Melinda and the Innocence Program paid for the testing of his DNA.
Okay.
So it was transferred through them. So they're saying, oh, that's not reliable because you could have tampered with it, which is frustrating because then the court system should have handled the testing.
Right, exactly. Well, right. It is harder to get someone out of jail that doesn't belong there than it is, you know,
to put them in.
So in my eyes, there should be a more lengthy process in which you're going to convict somebody of this.
But usually there is.
I know, and not here. And this is what's so frustrating.
Well, things were complicated now if Melinda and the group were going to move forward with the investigation. They had already been adamant that they had a suspect, and they knew they couldn't just do that again if they wanted to be taken seriously. They would have to know for sure that the next person they accused was their guy. Now, in order to do this, it meant the DNA had to match. So before the state tested it, she figured that she should too. So Melinda pored over shows like Forensic Files and the usual investigation discovery lineup that I'm sure we've all seen. And she learned how to collect and preserve the DNA that she went through. And she learned how to collect and preserve the DNA. And she went through that list she had compiled. Melinda would follow the men to bars and restaurants and collect the things they left behind.
Oh my God.
The straws, the cigarettes, the cups, anything that they put their mouths on. She personally had to pay for all the DNA testing, tens of thousands of dollars, to see if these men were a match, because she couldn't just accuse someone again. They wouldn't believe her. She'd be the boy that cried wolf. So she needed to know it was a match before she made this accusation to the courts. She also used any possible contributions that she got from the rallies that she held for Clarence or the website she had created called FreeClarence.com. But the majority of the money was hers. But unfortunately, none of those samples were a match. While Melinda was on this crusade, she was not treated well. The media and the public made her out to be a heartless woman that stood by her man after he had hurt a child, her niece, and raped and murdered her own mother. But what helped her through it was having her family by her side again. It didn't matter what anyone thought, as long as April and Brooke were on her side. And she eventually got justice for Clarence.
I mean, I think this whole thing is pretty crazy because this woman is dishing out all this money through various fundraising and all this other stuff that she's doing. But let's get back to the real cause of this. None of that would have to happen if they would, if the actual prosecutors or police departments would just test everything. They have it. They can go around and do the same thing. You know, I mean, I don't know who would actually be willing to give a sample, but at least if she's bringing the samples to them, why not do it? I mean, let's figure out if the actual guy is out there, you know, if we're trying to get the heat off of Clarence, let's just see what else we can kind of procure, you know?
I think that's a good point. And I think that it's also really a testament to how much she really loved her husband and believed in justice and I think wanted to seek justice also for her children as well, because she didn't want them thinking that their father did this or growing up with the stigma of their father doing this either.
Yeah, I mean, no one wants that, because obviously she's being ostracized by everyone else in the community. So it's just a really bad place for her to be too. And when you really think about this, the entire family has been affected in some form or another.
Right. And I think that it takes a lot for someone to say that the only opinion that matters is that of their own family, because, I mean, who wants to be villainized by the media the way that she really was? But she really only cared what April and, of course, Brooke felt. And they were adamant that also at this point that it wasn't Clarence.
And, you know, a lot of people say that, like they'll say, I don't care. But I would say most people who say that do care.
Right.
So I'm glad to see, though, that they are saying something and then really sticking to that, you know, because it's only going to help her, whether or not, you know, regardless of the outcome of this, I think.
Well, one of the tactics that Melinda had for finding new suspects was to scour the internet and newspapers for similar crimes that happened throughout the county or neighboring counties. One morning, she found exactly what she had been looking for all along. That piece of information that would make everything click into place. And when she found it, she truly couldn't believe it, because the killer had been there all along.
Okay.
In the article, she read that a man named Earl Mann had been convicted for sexually assaulting his three daughters.
Whoa, okay.
Who were his three daughters? The girls that lived two doors down from Judith Johnson's house.
Get out of town. Wait. Is this the one that she went to go? No.
Yes.
The one that was outside?
Yes. The ones that she played with.
Get out of here.
The daughters of Tanya Brazel, or Brazil. I don't know how she pronounces that. Remember her? She's the woman that kept Brooke waiting on her front porch, beaten, bruised, and bloodied. The woman that never called 911, but instead drove the 6-year-old home. No one ever thought too much about that in all the commotion and craziness of the stampede to convict Clarence. But the answer had always been there, if they would have just looked.
Hold on. This is what a revelation this is. I have a feeling about something. I want you to be aware of it and the audience. Do you think now that this woman, or the mother of these kids, do you think that maybe she knew that the husband or the ex-husband, however, whatever he was to her at this point, do you think that she knew what he did and didn't want any involvement? So that's why she was left outside?
Well, we will find out exactly what happened that morning.
Oh my God.
Earl Mann had just gotten out of prison again for another one of his aggravated offenses. And when he did, he stayed at Tanya's house, as she was his common-in-law wife, and they had three daughters together. Mann was a brutal and uncaring man. His rap sheet was long and violent. He had beaten an older man to a pulp in a robbery. He hit a man from behind with a pool cue and stole the bag of food that he had. He punched a man and then dragged him down his own driveway and dropped his unconscious body into the road. But the worst things he did, he reserved for his daughters. Little is known or can be found about the abuse the girls suffered. All I have found was that the same brutal sexual assault that was seen in the Johnson Sutton case occurred to the girls as well. So that says it all. And from 2000 to 2002, the newspapers were a little more careful about publishing those details. So obviously I didn't find more of that, nor I think do we need to get into detail about it. We know how brutal it was. I did find that the investigation into the allegations of Mann having molested and raped his daughters had dates involving the attacks on them. The brutality occurred on December 10th, 1995, June 5th, 1998, which was only 2 days before the murder of Judy and the attack of Brooke.
Okay, so it was all done within around the same time frame.
Well, and then another date is October 2nd, 1998 and January 4th, 1999. All of these dates correspond with when he's released from prison and Tanya lets him stay with them.
That's crazy.
He gets released from prison, lives in your house, is molesting and raping your daughters, and then you let him come back. Again and again and again, because if you didn't catch it, those dates ranged from December of 1995 to January of 1999.
That is horrible. That is unspeakable, honestly. Not only what he did, but unspeakable what she's allowing as well.
Right.
You know, I mean, I know that there's like, you know, it's not the whole piece of the puzzle. Like, we don't know the whole thing, but still, I mean, if this is taking place, your daughters are your top priority. Should probably not allow him in the house ever again and never allow to see them. So I don't know what is going through your mind.
On April 19th, 2002, he was convicted of those rape charges. Months later, his conviction was published in the paper, and that is when Melinda saw it and put it all together.
I was just thinking, like, how did that happen? Okay.
Because she read the paper and saw that he committed the same acts as were committed against her mother and her niece, and he lived two doors down, and the date of the one attack was only a few days before, well, essentially the day before the attack on them, because it happened the night of June 6th. So that meant that he had to have been home during that time.
That's crazy.
At this point, Melinda had a team of 20 law students at the University of Columbus working with her alongside the Ohio Innocence Project. And when she shared this information with them, they knew that he had to be their man. They all knew that they would have to know definitively that Earl Mann was their man before they brought him to the prosecutor's office again, though. Melinda tried to write to him while he was in prison. She flirted with him in letters and tried to be like one of those women who were obsessed with criminals in jail, like a pen pal search kind of thing. She implied that she would send him money. She would kind of like give him whatever he wanted, but he never wrote back. She was trying to get a letter from him so he would lick the envelope.
Could I just tell you, I've never seen anybody go to these lengths, and I love it.
I know, it's really incredible. I mean, it's sad
that we have to have it happen, but I'm so impressed with her to take such initiative like this.
Right.
Like, it is just, it's, I don't know, it's just nice to see, I guess.
Inspiring.
It is, because, I mean, the lengths that someone will go, you know, people will say they'll do anything, but, I mean, not everybody actually puts that into practice.
And she certainly has.
Yeah.
But just when they thought they were out of luck, something crazy happened. In a twist of fate, Earl Mann had been placed in the same cell block as Clarence Elkins.
No way.
Yes. So Melinda explained it all to Clarence, that if he wanted to prove his innocence, he would have to collect Mann's DNA himself while they were in prison together.
Oh my God. Are they, so they're working together to try to get it?
Well, now Melinda and Clarence right. are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're working together. Oh my God, this is cool. This should be a movie.
I agree.
What a movie that would be.
I feel like every case we cover should be a movie.
That's true.
Mann being in the same pod as him meant that he would have plenty of opportunities to do this. Melinda told Clarence that he always had to have a clean tissue and a plastic baggie on him so he could pick up anything that he had left his DNA on. It took a few days, but finally, while they were outside, Clarence had seen Mann flick a used cigarette butt on the ground.
Perfect opportunity. Go grab it.
He kept it in his... Well, he can't just run and do it because everyone in prison is going to be like, what are you doing? And are you trying... Like, this would be a bad look. And he does also have to protect himself in this prison.
That's true.
So he kept it where it was in his vision the whole time. And when no one was watching, he picked it up and sealed it. He mailed it to Melinda and tested the sample using $25,000 of her own money. And some of that was through donations. But again, mainly it's her own money. And it was worth every penny because it was a match.
Yes. That's crazy that it cost $25,000. Let me just say that.
And that's half the price, just so you know.
It's half the price.
Private DNA testing.
Wow.
Like that. Now, the prosecutor at the time was presented with the information they had. Her name was Sherry Bevan Walsh. She was apprehensive to do the testing at the state lab again because of the amount of testing that had already been done on the autopsy swab and the fact that a transferable skin cell would not secure a conviction, even if it were to be a match. She said later that she wanted to be careful, but that the pressure was on. Melinda and her team had held a press conference and appealed to the Ohio Attorney General, who at the time had been running for the governor of Ohio, and they were only a month out from re-election. The man, Jim Petro, supported dismissing all charges against Clarence Elkins. Bevins Walsh said that her apprehension disappeared completely when she read the case file of Earl Mann. He had violently abused his daughters in the same exact way he had Judy and Brooke and had done so for years. They had always thought that Clarence had done it because of the anger that he held for his mother-in-law. But this made more sense. Mann was two doors down, and Clarence was 45 minutes away. Mann had a violent history, especially against small girls Brooke's age, and Clarence had none. It just made sense that it wasn't Clarence, like it hadn't made sense all along.
This has to be, I know it's not over, but this has to be one of the most incredible cases I think I've ever listened to, because it just is crazy how all this transpired, like every part of it.
Right.
Anyway, I mean, I'll hold the rest for the end, but that, I mean, really though, I mean, every part is just an absolute shocker.
Yeah, every twist and turn and the fact that he was right there, like all the police had to do, detectives, was take a second look and be like, you know what, was there any weird activity? I don't know, maybe the fact that a mother of three found a girl on her doorstep that looked like she had just been through a war, and she left her there for 45 minutes and she never called the police. That's not odd to you.
Right.
So all they had to do was a cursory check into that and they would have found their man.
Yeah, right? Because you would have talked to the wife.
Instantly.
You know, would have talked to her, and, you know, one thing would have led into another.
You would have looked at who lives in the house.
Correct. And their prior convictions.
And you would have stopped the abuse of these girls sooner.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many victims here.
So many victims here.
Well, in addition to the DNA evidence, the law students with the Ohio Innocence Project found another interesting piece of information. Now, this is from official court records. On January 5th, 1999, while Elkins' investigation was ongoing, Earl Mann had been arrested by the Barberton police. Now, if you remember from the dates where he abused his daughter, he seems to be doing these crimes in twos. I don't know how to explain it, but he seems to have these violent streaks, okay? Because he is going to sexually assault his daughters on June 5th. And then on June 6th, that night, is when he breaks into Judy Johnson's house, rapes and kills her, and then tries to kill and rapes Brooke Sutton, who's 6 years old. Okay, so that happened within 2 days of each other, all of those things. Well, one of the dates that we have that he violently sexually assaulted his daughters on January 5th, which is the next day, he was arrested by the police for two strong-arm robberies. Now, strong-arm robberies are robberies in which the victim is surrounded by a group of individuals who brutally beat the victim while robbing them. And these things are commonly seen in cities, these strong-arm robberies. During the course of the arrest, Mann, who was drunk at the time, asked the patrol officer, Gerald Antonucci, he said, "Why don't you charge me with the Judy Johnson murder?"
What?
So in 1999, this man told a police officer from Barberton, I hope that's how you pronounce the town name. If not, we'll hear about it. But so he's saying, "Why are you not arresting me for the Judy Johnson murder?" Essentially 7 months after it took place.
That's so bizarre. Like,
so Gerald Antonucci, this patrol officer who arrested him, so in compliance with his training that mandated him to report anything that officers believe the detective bureau should know about, Antonucci wrote an interdepartmental memo stating that Mann said that to him and directed it to the department that was investigating Judy Johnson's murder.
Right, and they did nothing.
They did nothing.
That's crazy talk.
Antonucci stated that he wrote the memorandum that day and placed it in the mailbox that, according to department procedures, was emptied each day by a member of the detective bureau and was supposed to disseminate it to the detectives working on that specific case. However, the Mann memorandum was not disclosed to Elkins or the prosecution by the police department and was never produced because they got rid of it. So yeah. They knew, on top of everything that was happening, that there's another man they should look into, and they never did. This is before his trial, by the way.
This is all before the trial. Okay. Yeah. I'm just saying that for them not to look into somebody else or investigate any small or big detail that we have described and outlined here. Honestly, it's just like him. He's an abomination. It is an abomination for this to take place this way. You got this guy walking around doing what he's doing right after he's been released, and this police department does not care that you have somebody walking around the neighborhood like that.
It's gross negligence.
It is. I mean, to the highest level. Unbelievable.
So that meant that Mann should have been looked at as a suspect in 1999.
Day one.
And again, this is 5 months before Clarence was convicted. So imagine if that information was brought forth at trial, or his defense attorneys could have known about that. But they thought they had their guy. Like I said, this is a gross miscarriage of justice. On December 15, 2005, Sherry Bevin Walsh petitioned the courts to vacate Clarence Elkins and dismiss all charges. He was immediately released from custody. But in total, he served 6.5 years in prison for a crime he never committed. A crime so brutal, you can imagine that his stay in prison was not a good one.
Right, because when you go to prison, they find out very quickly what you're in there for.
Especially when, and this was like a high media case.
Right, so you have to imagine that everyone around him knew what he was accused and sentenced for.
Yeah.
So his life was in jeopardy for 6 years, and I'm surprised nothing happened to him. Because that is not taken lightly in prison, regardless of what prison it is.
Right.
You know, these are bad people. You know, to the left and right of you, these people are horrible people, but they don't tolerate that as being a crime being committed.
Right.
They think that that's sacrilegious, you know, compared to what they're in there for.
Well, yeah, there's like which a code is, amongst you know, criminals.
But right, it's very odd behavior. But whatever. My point is that his life was in jeopardy for 6 years. And I hope that when he gets out of here, he better be compensated to the highest degree.
We'll talk about it.
Good.
Tanya Brazil was also questioned. And she admitted that Earl Mann had returned home in the early morning hours of June 7th, 1999. She said he had deep scratches on his back. And when she asked how he got those scratches, he told her that he had sex with a wild woman. And that must have been Judy Johnson fighting for her life. Tanya went on to admit that the reason she left Brooke on the porch for as long as she did was because when Brooke arrived, Earl was home. And he got angry and insisted that she not let the girl inside the house and see him. Tanya said she was scared of him and listened to him. And when ordered to keep her outside and to keep police away, she did. So she didn't call the police and she just drove the girl home. And then, if you remember, the second Tanya met April, She said Clarence did it. She was trying to perpetuate the fact that her husband didn't, even though she knew he did.
That's disgusting.
Earl Mann, who was in prison for the rape of his three daughters, was officially indicted for the attacks of Judy Johnson and Brooke Sutton on June 29th, 2007, just over 9 years after the attacks took place. On August 18th, 2008, he pleaded guilty to the crimes and was sentenced to 55 years to life, in addition to the time that he was already serving. After this, Melinda went to work for the Innocence Project, and her sons went on to attend the police academy to stop something like this from ever happening again. Even though you can make an argument that the system is broken because Gerald Antonucci did try to do the right thing. Melinda said that she was excited to finally be able to focus on happy moments in life with her family and no longer talk or deal with the court systems in a way that's personal to her, but she definitely was on a crusade to continue working for the Innocence Project. Clarence Elkins had been able to go home for Christmas in 2005. In a statement to the media, he said that when he got home, he told Brooke that he loved her and never blamed her for anything, and expressed deep gratitude to his wife for standing by him and working relentlessly against all odds to free him. He also thanked the law students that worked on his case. But on a sad note.
No, there's no sad note. This is a good ending.
Clarence and Melinda's marriage did not last.
Oh, no.
They got divorced. Isn't that so sad?
I mean,
now, we don't know the inner workings of their relationship.
Yeah.
But it's sad because she really fought so hard. But not a lot was said about the divorce. Obviously, that's personal business for them. Except that some tensions remained and there was not enough there to keep the relationship intact. I mean, that's a lot to go through as a couple.
It is. But I hope that they're at least friends.
They are.
Okay.
So right. Clarence filed for divorce in 2006. Both have remarried, but remained very close friends. And they now share grandchildren together to, you know, to enjoy and have.
Okay. All right. I mean, that's sad, but at least they're friends and it's not like some weird tension.
No, there's no okay. like bad blood there.
All right.
In November 2010, the city of Barberton agreed to settle a lawsuit brought against four police officers involved in the investigation and prosecution of Clarence for $5.25 million. The state of Ohio separately paid him a little over $1 million in compensation.
Hope it's tax-free.
I would hope so. Clarence had many things stolen from him since the day of his arrest. He suffers from PTSD and has struggled integrating back into society after an ordeal like that. And, as you can imagine, trusting anyone. Brooke also suffered many tremendous losses. Her innocence, her grandmother. And after the attack, she felt the weight of the world on her shoulders as she had been the one to identify her uncle. But as she continued to be a strong survivor, but she has continued to be the strong survivor that she showed herself to be since she was only 6 years old. And we cannot forget that Judy Johnson was viciously attacked and lost her life trying to defend herself and her granddaughter. Her last moments were filled with pain and fear, not knowing what would happen to Brooke. There are also many other victims Earl Mann leaves in his wake, his daughters included. So it is a good thing Melinda worked as hard as she did to ensure that Mann's path of destruction was brought to an end.
I have to say I am so impressed and just proud of her for doing this and taking that on. You know, I mean, what she went through, what she had to lay out, all the networking that she had to do to get him out and to get the real person responsible for what happened to the family members. I mean, what happened to them is horrible. And there are so many victims from this man. And the whole episode, I'm just sitting here hoping that by the end that real justice would be served, because I felt from the very beginning it wasn't. And all those police officers, they should be ashamed of themselves.
I agree.
It's disgusting. And he was just able to terrorize people like that. It's just sad.
Yeah, and I think it, on a larger note too, like this case became a major example used by innocence organizations and legal experts to highlight certain things that happen here. So hopefully it's not repeated again. But the dangers of tunnel vision in investigations, and we've talked about that in other cases too, where if a detective or detectives working a case hone in on one suspect and one suspect only, everything outside of that suspect falls to the wayside, and that's sometimes where you find your answers. So even though you might really think it's one guy, you really do have to follow through with other leads that are given to you, because not only is that going to make your case stronger against the person you may think it is, but it might lead you to who actually did it, and that's what your job is for.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between going on your gut, but then completely just forgetting that other suspects could exist.
And also it brings up the fact that, unfortunately, eyewitness identifications are not something that we can rely on, especially when the victim themselves has been traumatized in the event that they suffered. And how important it is to preserve and retest DNA evidence years after a conviction, which unfortunately there is such a backlog on the testing of DNA evidence. And it's sad to think that there could be other Clarence Elkins sitting in prison right now.
Yeah, that's true. And also the importance in DNA storage.
Yes.
And the collecting of it.
And even after you get a conviction, continue storing it properly.
Yep. Because that was a big thing in this as well.
Right. I mean, this case is just wild. And we really cannot wait to hear what you guys have to say about it either, because, I mean, it was something that I was just thinking about in the weeks that I was writing this, like, oh my God.
Yeah. It's like every parent's fear, you know?
And then every person's nightmare.
Yes, that, you know, you could be put away for something that you didn't do. You're
completely helpless. I mean, he was helpless in this, and he was so obviously innocent. And they even knew the DNA didn't match him, and he still got convicted.
Yep, which is insane to me. That through every layer of quote-unquote protection that there is, like, it doesn't matter. You just fall right through it all.
Right. Like, you think, oh, the DNA was not a match. I'll be exonerated.
Or they won't charge me with this. There's no way. Right. And then here we are. Oh, here I am in a jail cell. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, before we go, what I want to do is I want to say thank you to our most recent supporters on Patreon. So a big thank you to Sarah, Connor Phelan, Sherry Parker, Petra Slaughter, Alicia Scanlon, Ida Mae Willumsen, Jennifer W., Nigel, Michelle Masters, Sarah B., Kristen Huston, Emma, Beth Rosenthal, Julianne Ford, Slightly Suspicious After Dark, Amy Eaton, Tara, Annette Phillips, T33, Angie Jacobson, Karen Dawn, and my Heather, the best coworker ever. Thank you for joining. Lindsay, Tamika Carasqualo, Patricia Phillips, Lily B., and Lauren Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it, and we hope that you're enjoying those extra episodes. And really, guys, we cannot wait to hear what you have to say about this episode. Until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.